Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The 2008 recession changed the landscape for nonprofits in the United States with decreased funding, especially from big contributors. So how are they filling the gap? Last week, the Columbus Foundation kicked off the Big Give, the first ever 24-hour fundraising event for Central Ohio nonprofits. In just 24 hours, they raised more than $8.7 million. Social media is being credited for much of the success. Right now, we welcome back our social media consultant, Betsy Hubbard, co-founder of Mindset Digital. Welcome back, Betsy.
Thanks, Ann.
And also joining us today is Carol Harmon. She's the Vice President for Communications and Marketing at the Columbus Foundation. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you, Ann.
So, more than 600 nonprofits participated in the Columbus Foundation's Big Give, and a total of 13,430 transactions raised, as I said earlier, more than $8.7 million over 24 hours. So that's a lot of numbers, but they're worth mentioning. Were you surprised, Carol, at the success, or was this what you were shooting for?
Well, we were shooting for the moon on this, of course. This was an opportunity for the community to work together and support our community's nonprofits, which, as you mentioned, have great needs at this time, particularly in human services. There's a great increased demand for those services. But we were truly amazed. The community just stepped up. We saw an outpouring of generosity for our community's nonprofits in that 24 hours.
Now, there were other ways to learn about the Big Give besides social media, but so to what extent do you credit social media with this for the success?
We used the nonprofits that were part of the Big Give are part of a database called Power Philanthropy. So all of those 600 organizations were eligible and were part of the Big Give. And so you have almost 600 nonprofits that could get out there and go ahead and communicate with their donor audiences and engage them around the Big Give.
Betsy Hubbard, it's not just happening in Columbus.
No, not at all. This is just another great example of how online tools and social media are changing a field. So we see a lot of trends in philanthropy in that the online tools are letting more people get involved. First big trend we see is a move towards more grassroots involvement, like in the Obama campaign. Of the millions of dollars he raised, the vast majority came in small dollar donations. It's easier to go after small donors because the costs of doing so are lower, so you can broaden your base and get more people involved. We're also seeing how social media is being used for team-based fundraising, like Pelotonia. Mm-hmm. So there you have people reaching out to their friends and neighbors for donations, using their social connections to raise funds on behalf of an organization. That is a second big trend. And then the third big trend we're seeing, how social media is changing fundraising, is really giving donors more choice over how their dollars are being used. So it used to be that people would be raising money for maybe just organizations. But now there's tools that allow you to make donations to specific projects. An example of this might be DonorsChoose.org, which allows classroom teachers to go online and post up a project. They might need 25 poetry books, or they might need an art easel, and they might just need to raise $125. Well, they can open up that fundraising to the entire country and collect small donations to achieve that goal. So a lot of what's happening, and I think the Big Give is a great example of this. It's moving beyond just the big donors and trying to allow everybody to have a piece of this, everybody to make small dollar donations, which add up.
I was going to say, how small were some of the small dollar donations?
Well, it took $20 to be part of the Big Give. The range was $20 to $220,000.
Wow. So you felt like, I mean, people feel like they can participate in it. This is accessible to them. It's a two-way street.
It's absolutely a two-way street. And in 2008, we created what's called Power Philanthropy, a database of nonprofit organizations. It allows anyone to go in and find information about the nonprofits that they care about and give to the nonprofits they care about.
Part of the power of this is that it's especially important. Online giving is the way that most first-time givers give. Mm-hmm. So this research shows that nonprofits, it really makes sense for them to reach out through online channels in order to bring in new donors. And so overall, online donations are not a huge part of most nonprofits' budget, but it's the fastest growing part of their budget. So anything that can be done to help bring in those new donors is really an investment in the future.
We're talking about the Big Give with Carol Harmon, Vice President for Communication and Marketing at the Columbus Foundation, and also Betsy Hubbard. She's a social media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. Or are you one of the people that participated in the Big Give? Give us a call. Tell us what you thought about that. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. They'll only be with us for about another 8 or 9 minutes. So if you want to get that call in right away, we appreciate it. 614-292-8513. We'd love to hear from people who participated in the Big Give. The idea of a 24-hour fundraiser like this, is social media almost required to do this kind of event, Carol Harmon?
Well, I would say it gave us great success for the Big Give. Not only did we have the social media tactics that the Columbus Foundation used to get the word out to our own donors and get the word out to nonprofits, but as we said, we had the nonprofits as well.
And it was a constant drumbeat during that 24 hours, at least from where I sat it was, and it wasn't bothersome at all, but that you were getting it from a lot of different places, and you couldn't have done that on television or radio.
It was very effective.
What are you hearing from other foundations and nonprofits around the country? Is this something, have you talked with other large foundations like your own around the country that are doing the same sort of thing, Carol?
Absolutely. There's a handful of community foundations around the country that have done similar efforts. You know, you've got Pittsburgh that most recently, I think San Diego's launching something in a couple weeks, and you're seeing many of these foundations offering what we did, which was a prorated match. There was $1 million that was contributed by Columbus Foundation donors and our governing committee. And that seems to be the easiest way to make sure everybody can be part of the Big Give with the prorated match.
Is that, Betsy, you talked about teams and that kind of a thing. To what extent has that grown? Peletonia raised, what, $13 million that way?
Yeah, $13 million that way. You're seeing that a lot because it's always been an effective tactic in fundraising. I mean, I think back to when my mom used to go door to door for the American Cancer Society. You know, it's easier to write a check if your neighbor believes in the cause. You know, appeal.
Right. It's the same thing.
It's the same thing. It's just now I can post it on Facebook, or I could post on Facebook, I just made a donation. You know, there's only 8 hours left. Why don't you donate too? So I can reach out to my friends. So you're amplifying that outreach. It's no longer just the nonprofit trying to get potential donors. It's your donors spreading the word for you and trying to recruit their friends. That's what the social media has allowed to happen.
How is it skewing the demographic too? Is it bringing in people that maybe hadn't given before when you do something like the Big Give with social media? Carol?
Well, we had over 10,000 people that gave, so it certainly brought some new people to the Columbus Foundation.
And anything else we know about the demographic of people who, is it across the board now with social media?
Yeah, well, we do know that online donors are of all ages, and that it's not just small dollar donations. There's a lot of online donations of $1,000 or, you know, even much more. So it's not like this is just something that people in their 20s do by any means. It, you know, all of us, we all shop on Amazon. It's a lot easier to push that, you know, button and pay by credit card than it is to write out a check and stuff it in an envelope and find a stamp and remember how much stamps are today and, you know, get it to the mailbox. And I mean, that just seems like a hassle in this real-time, fast-moving world. So all of us are shifting more towards this style of giving, but certainly it is bringing in more younger and newer donors, especially.
Henry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Henry. Hello, Henry.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the radio.
You're on the air. Welcome.
Okay. I participated in the Big Give. I would like to make a comment to the effect that because of the computer and the way the computer is laid out, it was difficult to figure out what charities to give. For instance, Actors Theater was one place we gave to, but Actors Theater has an apostrophe after the final S in Actors. And we did not know that. We found it out later, and we were able to give there. But that's an example of what the computer does. You have to type in the words exactly as they're needed.
Oh, it's not a multiple choice then.
You can search. You can search by keyword.
Okay.
And sometimes that's the easiest way to search. But that's good information to have. I'll share that.
Yeah. So you could just search by theater maybe or...
Absolutely. And it would bring up all the theaters in Central Ohio.
Henry, have you ever participated in something like this before?
No, have not.
In general, not if outside of the complication with Actors Theater, how did you like it? What did you think?
I liked it, but I would have given to more charities if I had known how to spell the darn word.
Okay. Duly noted.
The other thing that I would like to know is how did the Columbus Federation get their money to match all these gifts?
The Columbus Foundation? Uh-huh. Okay, where the $1 million came from. Thanks, Henry.
The $1 million came from Columbus Foundation donors and our governing committee.
Okay, so it was just something that you plan and you set aside for. Okay, so let's listen to a YouTube rap video put together to thank the donors of Bowling Green State University's new Stroh Center, multipurpose arena on the campus at BGSU. The video features freshman Mikey Roscoe Blair singing the rap.
BG Stroh Center, let's go. Kurt Stroh came to BG way back in the 60s. He looked around and thought this place was nifty. Rocking the mic in his Cardigan sweater. Calling play-by-play straight up from Wapakoneta. When it comes to the D's, this man's in total control. Picking popcorn machines and choosing urinal bowls. He gave me cool eight, man, his name is short as a five. Cause you can see it in lights from my 75.
All right, BGSU, the catchy song, is performed by Bowling Green students, and the donors, like Kerm Stroh, are featured as elderly basketball players contributing to the university spirit as well as providing funding. How does this video show the new face of fundraising and the potential for social media? I mean, it seems like it's something you've told me a million times now, Betsy. It's more casual.
It is more casual. I mean, this is high energy. It's fun. The donors show a great sense of humor in this by showing up in their sweatbands and their basketball uniforms and, you know, trying to dribble the ball on the court. It is just a whole new spirit around this, showing that this isn't just about, you know, stuffiness. It is really about people who care about the organizations that they're a part of. And so this really celebrates the power of philanthropy, but does it with a whole new style and a whole new tone. And there's a viral nature to this. So perhaps one day you would have just written a letter to a donor saying thank you so much, or you invited your donor to a thank you brunch. But now here's a video that's been seen by more than 100,000 people on YouTube. ESPN wrote about it in their blog and called it brilliant. I mean, it really raises the visibility of this project. So if you're going to thank your donor, maybe you want to do it in a really grand way. And this is a great example of doing it in a grand way.
So, Carol, no pressure. Any plans to...
Well, it definitely shows how fun philanthropy can be. I will say with the Big Give, we initially launched the word at Highball Halloween.
So... Right. When we played from that at the top of the hour, if anybody wants to go back and listen to that. That was a lot of fun to hear, too. A lot of energy. Very exciting. And I was reminded just a few minutes ago that if anyone can ever remember what to write when they want to go to the Big Give, they can always say WOSU. That's
just
always very, very easy. Four small letters. So if anyone's ever confused. Carol Harmon, thanks so much for joining us today. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much.
Carol Harmon, she's Vice President for Communication and Marketing at the Columbus Foundation. And Betsy Hubbard, thanks for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ann.
Betsy Hubbard, social media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. Coming up, we're going to talk about those low-cost tablets. Are they worth it? Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Like the alleged victims of sexual abuse at Penn State, Dominic Carter says he was abused as a child, and like many victims, he hid it for decades.
After it happened was almost worse than what actually did occur, because it stays in the back of your mind your entire life.
I'm Brian Naylor, finding help for the victims. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 54 degrees with cloudy skies in downtown Columbus, a high of 59 today. There is a chance of rain tonight, a low of 44 degrees. Expect some rain on Wednesday and a high of 50.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Home Instead Senior Care, providing companionship, dementia, Alzheimer's, and hospice support. More at 1-800-4-SENIORS. Home Instead. To us, it's personal.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
For years, we've been placing the things you love at your doorstep. Now, we're placing them at your fingertips. Introducing Kindle Fire, a Kindle for movies, music, apps, games, web browsing, and of course, reading.
That's a TV ad for Amazon's Kindle Fire tablet, one of two new low-cost tablets new to the market this month. It was funny when I looked at the chat below that video when I was looking at it earlier. Someone said, I don't know how long it would last on my doorstep. Joining us now to talk about Amazon's Kindle Fire and the Barnes & Noble Nook tablet is Steve Fox. He's editorial director for PC World in San Francisco, where he oversees editorial content and strategy for PCWorld.com and PC World magazine. Welcome to the show, Steve.
It's great to be here.
PC World says the Amazon Kindle Fire and the Barnes & Noble Nook tablet are establishing new price points for tablets and bringing impressive capabilities. What are we talking about with these price points?
Well, the Fire, which is from Amazon and which shipped yesterday, came out at basically $200, $199. And then you have the next version from Barnes & Noble is going to be $249, and that is the Nook tablet. And compare this to things more in the $500 price range for what we think of as a full-featured tablet, you know, your iPads and the like, the Samsung Galaxy Tab and others like that.
So what's the difference between these and, say, the iPad?
Well, they're definitely do not have all the capabilities that you would have in an iPad. You know, they're missing things like, you know, cameras and stereo speakers. And if you look at, say, the Nook tablet, you know, no Bluetooth, doesn't have GPS. So there are some things that it doesn't have. What these do have is they have great screens, and they are wonderful devices for consumption of content, for media consumption. That's really what this is about.
And when you say that, you mean things that you read?
Yeah, well, read, watch.
Okay.
Listen to any sort of media. I mean, think about for a second the Amazon, the store that Amazon has built up, right? Everyone knows Amazon as having this amazing marketplace. So they really need a device that people can consume this, right? And they can sort of bind them to Amazon in some way. They can be going back to Amazon and getting the information all the time. So suddenly you have this, $200 device, the Kindle Fire. It hooks in to the marketplace that Amazon already has. It comes with a trial membership to a service that Amazon has, which is called Amazon Prime. So that gets free streaming. You can even get loaned library books from it. Or, of course, you can buy things. And we all know, I certainly do it, Amazon customers are inclined to buy. So suddenly you've got this device that perhaps maybe even cost them money $200. They may lose money on it, but think of the razor and razor blade idea here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to make all this money on media. I know, for instance, I am waiting. I'm hoping that today my new Amazon Kindle Fire arrives on my doorstep. I ordered it about a month and a half ago. It shipped yesterday. It should be here today. I'm going to be using it immediately. I'll be using, reading things on it and the like. I mean, I do like my previous Kindle. This one's better. I still have one that's black and white. This is color. So there's a lot that really goes in its favor.
So, anyways, to our listeners, my guest is Steve Fox. He's editorial director at PC World. We're talking about the new lower cost tablets, the Amazon Kindle Fire and the Barnes & Noble Nook tablet, establishing new price points for tablets, as we were talking about earlier. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Have you ordered one of them? What are you hoping to find? 614-292-8513. You can also go on to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. So how do the Fire and the Nook tablet compare? The Nook tablet costs $50 more. Do you get anything more for that?
Yeah, I actually think that that currently looks like, you know, just based upon specs, looks like it may be somewhat more desirable. I mean, first off, it's got, you know, the, in terms of processor and all that, it's pretty beefy. But I think the main thing is it'll have more onboard storage. One of the things that, with 16 gigabytes, one of the things that the Amazon Kindle Fire does, it's expecting people to use the cloud. You're supposed to be downloading things. You're not supposed to be saving a ton of material on the device itself because it doesn't have, you know, a whole lot of space for it. You definitely get more space on the Nook tablet, and I think that will give it an advantage. We really love the screen that we saw on the Nook tablet. Mm-hmm. It's got this idea of it's laminated and bonded, so there's not a lot of space between the glass in the front and that LCD below, so it looks really sharp. And actually, both of these devices have lovely screens because they're really, as I said, about consuming content.
And they have touch capability, all of that.
Yeah, they have touch capability. And, of course, you know, on the Amazon side, they also have cheaper versions of the Kindle, things that are coming out now that are more like $99. So at that point, you know, it becomes really an impulse purchase. But the funny thing here is we've been talking about tablets. You know, it started with the iPad in 2010. We've been talking about tablets for a while, and everyone assumed there was this is what they would cost. They'd be $500, $400, $600, in that range. But this funny thing happened on the way to the ascension of this full-featured tablet, right? Say the iPad and others. And these cheapy e-readers, they beefed themselves up. They threw a few more capabilities in. They crashed the party, and they announced, you know, no, this is the new price point. It's going to be an interesting thing to see how this plays out, because there's a big difference, you know, between spending, you know, $199 and spending $500 and easily more if you're going to add more capabilities.
Yeah, I guess people were wondering back in 2010, all the way back in 2010, what would happen.
Yeah,
well, in this day and age, it's ancient history. But, you know, what would happen with e-readers? I mean, is there still a market for the old-fashioned Kindle?
I think there is. I mean, keep in mind, you're going to see these things for, you know, $99 and $79. I actually suspect that we will soon, at some point in the next few years, we'll see a free Kindle. When that happens, you know, it'd be hard not to buy it. But, I mean, realistically, Amazon is going to make their money on books. They're going to make their money on movies and other media. So I do think there is a market for these. The newest Kindle that we're seeing is one that's, I think it's something like $79 with ad support. In other words, you have to watch some ads. I was holding this thing, and it feels, you know, it obviously more than a piece of paper, but far, far lighter than a paperback book. So if you're just lying in bed and want to read something, it's holding it is, you know, trivial. It's really easy. Even these new the $200 one, it's less than a pound,
mm-hmm.
And you know that actually it's like 0.9 or something pounds. And you know, compare that to the iPad, which is a very, very nice device that's closer to, you know, pound and a half or so. It, believe it or not, that amount makes a big difference when you're holding something.
You know, I love my Kindle, but I've been thinking my mom might love it even more because she likes to read big, fat books. And I'm wondering about the demographics for all of this. Is that changing?
I imagine they would be. I mean, part of it is you do have some control over the size of the font, which
mm-hmm.
is a good thing
if
you're getting somewhat older. And the older Kindles, tended to be black and white. Obviously, the new one, the Nook, and the rest are color. So I think for people who like magazines, you're going to really want those sort of color capabilities. Of course, you're also going to want somewhat bigger screens. You know, these new devices are 7 inches. That's kind of tough to look at a magazine in that format.
Right.
But, you know, in general, as you think about who are reading magazines versus people who are getting their information elsewhere, say on the web, I think magazines are certainly skewing a little older. And so I think we'll see some of these, you know, bigger screen, more lush devices that will, you know, play very well in it's not really older markets because, you know, with technology, older means anything over, what, 18?
Exactly. It's all wrong. If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest is Steve Fox, editorial director at PC World. We're talking about those lower cost tablets, the Amazon Kindle Fire and the Barnes & Noble Nook tablet. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jessica, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. I am about to buy the, at least I was planning on until this broadcast, but I was planning on buying the iPad 2 tomorrow for my family for Christmas, and I was planning to use it for my three-year-old. I have her play educational games on it, and then, you know, also for the other members of the family, but mostly for her. And I did just buy the Kindle Touch for my 70-year-old father for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of wondering whether the iPad is a little overkill price-wise for my two-year-old after listening to this, the three-year-old, after listening to this broadcast. And maybe the Kindle Fire is better. And didn't know in regards to apps for kids whether the Kindle Fire had a lot of options.
Sure. Well, first off, welcome to the sandwich generation. I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that, you know, my six-year-old absolutely adores the iPad, although she calls it the big iPhone. So clearly that's the way that she's thinking of this. As far as whether it's overkill, it's actually a wonderful device, the iPad. It's a great device for kids. There are plenty of apps. There are going to be fewer apps, certainly initially, on the Fire. It's an Android, just, you know, not to get too far into the weeds, but, you know, the two primary operating systems on these, there's iOS, which is on the Apple side for the iPad and the iPhone, and you have Android, which is an operating system that appears on many tablets, and this modified version of Android, also on phones, by the way, but that appears on the Kindle Fire. But it is modified, so developers are going to have to actually create specific applications for the Fire. They will be doing this because the developers see money in this. They know that folks who use Amazon are accustomed to paying money for things. So that developers tend to develop applications, programs, when they think there'll be money for it. But coming out of the gate, you're going to have many more applications, including lots of wonderful things for kids on the iPad. So, you know, comes down to a money thing, but you may find that you get it for your it's your daughter, you said, Jessica, I think? And
yes. Yeah.
Okay, you may find you get it for your daughter, but, you know, guess who's going to actually be using it more? Might well be you.
Okay, great. That was very helpful. I really appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
Thanks, Jessica. 614-292-8513. Steve Fox, editorial director at PC World, will be with us for about 7 more minutes. So if you have questions about those lower-cost tablets, get them in right now. Rachel in Upper Arlington, welcome to the show.
Hi. Actually, I have a feeling that while I was on the phone getting clicked in here, I missed. I think I have a very similar question to Jessica. I was thinking about getting an Amazon Fire for my 11-year-old son, who is not a toy kid, and he wants an iPad. And my feeling is I'd rather have him drop, lose, or have stolen something cheaper. And I guess my other concern is that I just feel like the iPad is going to be more consumed by the adults, and, you know, maybe it'd be more like his. But on the other hand, if he can't play Angry Birds, which he's never really seen, but, you know, his friends can play Angry Birds, he wants to play Angry Birds.
And if you can't.
Yeah, and believe me, that's a big deal. I'm actually not sure. I mean, what I would imagine is that there will be a version of Angry Birds. I don't know if there is one yet.
Right.
For the Fire. But, you know, that's a very, to say it's a popular game is kind of an understatement. If you have an 11-year-old and you're working on really wanting him to be consuming more in the way of books and the like, it's a very nice experience for reading. You know, if anyone who's had, say, a Kindle, you know, it's a really easy way to read things. It's something pretty wonderful about just being able to, you know, hit a button and get whatever book it is that you want. It's a nice color screen, so there's also, you know, you can do graphic novels and the like, and of course there's movies. So it's not a bad solution for an 11-year-old. He'll probably have more fun on the iPad,
right?
Because, you know, that's what it's about. I mean, there's also, you know, you've got plenty of competitors, iPad competitors that are really, really pretty good, don't have quite the application support that the iPad has. But if you're looking at a full-fledged tablet, you know, you can also consider, not to make it more confusing for you, by the way, but, you know, you've got things like the Galaxy Tab 10.1. It's a 10-inch screen. Keep in mind, these new $200 devices, and we'd be talking about the Amazon or you know, the Barnes & Noble tablet. Those are 7 inches. So mm-hmm. it might be good to draw a little picture so you get a sense of what 7 inches looks like. It isn't big. It's enough that you can easily read, but it's, you know, it's not, doesn't have that, you know, full screen that you see on the larger tablets.
And one other quick question, and maybe you went over this before too. I'm assuming that you can access the web through these? I mean, if you have to access Amazon, you have to be able?
Yeah, the answer is absolutely. And the old Kindle had a kind of funky way of getting to the web. This is actually a pretty good browsing experience. The new Kindle Fire has a new browser called the Silk browser that should be able to do pretty much anything you would want to do on the web. My guess is including Flash, you know, and other things that, you know, that you don't necessarily get on the iPad.
Right.
So, yeah, browsing, it will absolutely do well. Remember, it's going to be through your Wi-Fi network at home, if you've mm-hmm. got that. It'll pick up on any Wi-Fi network and plug right in. You're not paying for a, you know, 3G or 4G service, you know, wireless service.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
Sure.
Colin? Hi, Colin.
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Okay. Hi, thanks. My mother is going to be 80 years old next year, next month. And my sister and I want to get her an iPad, and we wanted to download some books for her. And I was wondering, is there any way to, on any of these pads, to freeze the page or lock the page in while you're reading? Because she has a central tremor. And I'm afraid she'll get real frustrated with the – she's unable to do a mouse with the computer, but she can do the touch screen. So I was wondering, can you lock the pages while she's reading so that she doesn't get frustrated with moving them inadvertently?
You know, this is something I've never encountered. I haven't actually tried to do it, so I can't tell you. I mean, as far as I know, you have all of these navigation devices, and that is one of the catches here. You hit the navigation device, and it moves forward. So I actually don't know of a lock. I know the products relatively well, but, of course, the Fire, you know, we've only played with. We haven't had a real chance to put it through its full paces yet. So, unfortunately, I can't answer the question. That would be worth checking online once some of these are out.
It doesn't apply to many people, probably.
I don't know. Some people get... You can get irritated every time you flick the page if something happens. I mean, I see what you mean. If you have a tremor, I mean, I'm sure it's very stressful.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll just try to play around with it myself and see if I can figure it out.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about out of time. Steve Fox, thanks for joining the show today.
Oh, this was great. I enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Steve Fox, he's editorial director at PC World. And coming up, we're going to be talking about... the smart TV, or in some people's opinion, not so smart TV, with Russell Holly at geek.com. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Regis Philbin retires Friday from the daily talk show he's co-hosted for 30 years. The 80-year-old TV veteran also has a new memoir. In the next Fresh Air, Regis Philbin talks with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher and a discussion of living with wild turkeys. Also, are raccoons and other wild animals getting smarter? Join us for those discussions on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 11 till noon tomorrow on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from Cooper & Elliott, a law firm dedicated to protecting the vulnerable, preserving the rights of citizens, and creating safer communities through the civil justice system. Online at cooperelliott.com.
There are many ways to connect with the WOSU Newsroom. Follow WOSU News on Twitter or like our station on Facebook. And be sure to sign up for our Daily News Loop e-newsletter. Just visit wosu.org/email to register.
Cloudy skies today, a high of 59 degrees, a chance of rain tonight, a low of 44. There's a good chance of rain on Wednesday, a high of 50 degrees, clouds Wednesday night, a low of 33. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The web has changed how we watch television and movies. Netflix's streaming service is booming. Hulu has a library with entire seasons of current television shows. And anyone can create their own entertainment thanks to sites like YouTube and Vimeo. Today on Tech Tuesday, we're going to hear how TV manufacturers are adding web-enhanced features like apps and streaming to our traditional viewing experience. They're called smart TVs. So what's the deal with smart TVs? Joining us to talk about that is Russell Holly, the tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, I'm glad to be back, Ann.
So what's a smart TV?
Well, there are a lot of different companies working on different versions of a smart TV right now, but it's essentially a television that has, you know, almost computer-like functions built into it that allow you to access the web or applications that have been written. Some even allow you to stream services like Netflix or YouTube without the need to connect another box to the television.
Now, I was reading a column by one reviewer. The headline was, I returned my smart TV because the apps were dumb. How much
That's
is
definitely
that?
True. Yeah. A lot of these companies, you know, Vizio, for example, is a company who, you know, has opted to write some of their own programs. And the problem that you run into with some of these is the quality of the application often gets hindered by the hardware inside the television. It's hard to look at these televisions as, you know, both televisions and computers, but when the application runs really, really slowly, it doesn't, you know, it creates a poor experience.
So it's well, important. Go ahead.
It's important to keep in mind when, you know, dealing with these televisions that they don't tell you, you know, how fast things are going to load. It's not like a traditional computer where you can see how fast the processor is or how fast the RAM is. You really have to kind of try them out before you take them home.
So was the technology launched too soon, prematurely?
Well, I think that there were a couple of organizations who had a really great idea for boxes that you plug into the television that will provide that functionality. And a lot of the TV manufacturers decided that they could imitate some of those functions by building it into the television. And the first generation of these things were really not the best. But we're starting to see the second wave of these televisions come out made by companies like Sony, and, you know, Apple has a device that works with, you know, works with iTunes that plugs into the TV now as well to you know, create a better experience.
So you can upgrade your existing television now?
There are boxes that you can purchase that you can plug into an existing television to make it a smart television. Apple and Google both have, you know, Google TV and Apple TV. And each of these will provide, you know, smart TV functions. It's something that has been pretty competitive between the two of them for a little while now. The ability to bring a lot of this content that people are already enjoying on their phones or their tablets or their computers. Most people don't have, you know, a computer screen larger than, say, you know, 19 inches, or they have a laptop or they have an iPad or something like that. And when you gather, you know, five or six people around a 10-inch screen to look at something, it, you know, with a little tiny speaker on it, it creates a pretty poor experience. The TV is the largest screen in your house for most people, so it really creates a better experience to be able to, you know, to have share that experience on the television.
My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger at Geek.com. We're talking about smart television, smart TVs today. If you have a question or comment for Russell, give us a call right away, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post it there, or tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. So you mentioned Sony and a few other. What types of smart TVs are available now, and what are they costing?
Sony's Google TV is comparable with the, you know, most televisions in that price range. They have a 32-inch and a 46-inch right now that are running Google TV, and they start at about $700 for the 32. And really what you're looking at with these devices is it gives you access to not just, you know, basic, you know, web tools, you know, like you have Netflix, you have YouTube, you have a web browser that you can actually navigate the web with, and the remote control that you get from Sony has a, you know, a proper keyboard on it so that you can actually type things in. But it also has a marketplace that is similar to Google's Android Market that allows other developers, people who make applications, to write apps specifically for the Google television so that you can enjoy those services.
What about complaints about the systems crashing? Is it the same thing on a television as it is on your computer when it crashes?
I've played with a couple of these televisions, and I have to say that there are a few things more frustrating than the concept of having your TV reboot. but I have yet to have that happen to myself. But I've definitely heard experiences where, you know, the TV has to completely shut down and start back up, and because it's you know, got more computer in it than TV, you know, you kind of feel like you're waiting for your TV to load, and that's an odd experience to kind of have happen when you're so used to the TV being this instant service where it just kind of pipes in information from elsewhere.
Well, I probably would blend right in with my lifestyle, because when the power goes out in our house, which is often, we have to reboot the television. So I'm very familiar with that experience.
All right.
It is very irritating. So 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Larry in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Larry.
Welcome. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the computer connectivity that is integrated with, like, Microsoft Windows has the Media Center. And there's so many capabilities that are out there. Does your guest see any future with what your subject is right now? I mean, is there any future where it might become more integrated, whether it be Apple? I know Apple has Apple TV. Are these, like, set-top boxes going to be integrated into TVs? Or, you know, what does he see in the future?
Well, a lot of that integration into TVs is already starting. Like I said, Sony's taking the Google experience that was originally a separate box and merging it into the television. There's been a lot of talk recently about Apple possibly making a television that has, you know, the Apple TV experience, possibly, you know, so some additional features as far as being able to cooperate with your television and with your iTunes account. And Microsoft has had, as you said, the Media Center extender for a long time. Media Center hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention recently because it requires a fairly powerful computer in the home. It requires it to be, you know, connected either to an Xbox gaming console or connected directly to the television. And it's not always very user-friendly. You know, if you run into a problem, there's not a whole lot of ease of use as far as getting in and out of problems.
That help, Larry?
To be able to use that. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
You pretty much have to be a geek to use it, but I was just curious to see, you know, what's coming down the pike, you know, so to speak, to see who's going to integrate what. But then it goes back to, if you buy a TV today, it'll be obsolete in a year from now.
Anyways.
Well, I mean, that gets said about all kinds of technology, and the reality of the situation is that a lot of these, particularly this what I've seen with this wave of smart TVs that are coming out, Sony was one of the first companies to release the Google TV, and with Google, they've taken great strides to make sure that the device stays updated with the most current version of the software. So while you're looking at, you know, yes, the, you know, next year you're going to see, you know, something better than 1080 or, you know, 3D or 4D or something like that, it's good to know that the software that's driving some of these smart products are in fact being, you know, updated beyond the first version.
Oh, that's good. So it's like a smartphone where they upgrade the operating system. You could, because it has connectivity, it could actually upgrade itself.
Exactly.
Perfect.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Ann, for your program. It's a great program.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for listening. So, dumb question. When you're working with a smart TV, is it a handheld situation or what? How does that work?
You mean as far as controlling the
television? Yeah, do you have a control? How do you control it?
Well, very much like the remote control that you would get with a normal television.
Okay.
The Sony remote control, it has a few more buttons on it. You know, it has an actual keyboard. But actually, when you're dealing specifically with the Google TV, there is a separate application that Google helped design so that if you have an iPhone or you have an Android phone or you have, you know, one of those smartphones, you can actually control the TV from that phone, and it includes everything. You can control the volume. If you have a TiVo hooked up to the television, you can control that, all of it, with your phone or with the controller that would be provided with the device.
And when you have it up and your screen's up, what are you going to see? Is it going to look like the you know, your computer screen with the a menu on it, and but a menu like with icons and that sort of thing?
For the most part, what you see is you have, you know, the television service as it's coming in. If you've got, you know, Comcast or Verizon or what have you, the television service is coming in. And then if you want to access one of these features, you'll press the menu button and a small bar will come up across the bottom. It does very little to interfere with the actual television show that you're watching. And you can even activate a picture-in-picture function where the television show that you're watching will be, you know, obscured in a picture while you, you know, surf the web or something like that. But they do a lot to make sure that, you know, the service is pretty minimally invasive and it allows you to access all of those functions at the same time.
What about those shows where people vote online and that kind of a thing? Will you just be able to do that right from your television?
I think that's the big hope there, is that it creates an interactive experience between the television and the content that's being driven. I don't think there's anybody doing it just yet, but, you know, very much the way, you know, with the American Idol, you know, dial in and vote thing, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, very soon we start to see that kind of functionality show up.
614-292-8513. Don't wait to get the calls in. Our guest right now, Russell Holly, tech blogger at geek.com. We're talking about smart TVs. Are you interested in it? Give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So is it Sony's with Google TV? Who else is doing it?
Well, Sony's got a good connection with Google TV. Later this year, or beginning of next year, I should say, LG is going to start working with Google for some of their televisions. Logitech actually makes a separate box that you can connect to any television and gain some of the same, you know, smart TV functions. Like I said before, Apple's working on, you know, the smart TV function. There are some devices that are not quite as oriented at smart TV. They deliver some of the basic features like streaming Netflix and offering some basic browsing. The Netflix-powered Roku box, it's R-O-K-U, mm-hmm. is pretty cheap, and it's, you know, a $100 box that you connect to your television, and it gives you the ability to stream Netflix directly to the television. But the newer versions of the Roku box also give you a lot of the smart TV function as far as being able to surf the web and do those kind of things.
Okay, maybe I missed it. When you mentioned, like, say, the Sony with the Google, how much does that cost? You said 36 or 46 or 32-inch and a 46-inch. What are we talking about?
There's a 32-inch and a 46-inch mm-hmm. TV that have the smart function plugged into it. I don't know the price of the 46 on the top of my head, but the last time I looked, the 32 was around $700.
Okay, so pretty comparable to a high-end, and it's a Sony.
It's going to be a little tiny bit more than mm-hmm. you know, the same TV without the smart function built in, because there's a lot more that comes with the television, you know, for starters. You're not going to see a huge price difference.
John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Yes. I wanted to know what the smart TV technology, the Blu-rays and all that stuff, where you can run directly into the Internet. How can you know what services are available, like Netflix, Pandora, and some of the others, before you actually buy the set? Because most people can't tell you.
Well, a lot of the electronic stores, you know, specifically Best Buy and stuff like that, will have some pretty knowledgeable home entertainment staff. But on the box for all of these devices is pretty clearly labeled, you know, what the start-out functionality is. And in the case of Google TV, you know, the applications are constantly growing. You know, it has a marketplace where developers can push applications to it. So there's going to be more apps available for those kind of devices every day.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, John. So what's the feedback been from the television industry? I mean,
well, when Google TV first started out, there was a bit of a kickback specifically with that service, because it had a web browser that had the ability to not only surf the web but watch, you know, videos from the web. And there was kind of a negative response from a lot of the TV producer companies, you know, the Fox.com and NBC.com, where they had TV shows on their websites that you could watch, And there was a swell when the service first came out of people who said, you know, well, I can just cancel my, you know, my cable and just, you know, stream everything from this. And a lot of those companies responded immediately by blocking Google TV from being able to access those websites and watch those shows. And a lot of that is still there, but now the people who make these shows have the ability to write, you know, a Fox app that would go on to a Google TV so that they could push the content however they chose to the device. It was an interesting thing about a year ago when this first started happening, you know, because they obviously didn't want people to be able to watch this stuff on the TV for free, you know, despite having that same ability on a laptop or on a smartphone.
Lawrence, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. How are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Talking a little bit about the question I had while I was on hold there, but it was I really wanted to ask about, you know, what's out there today to be able to watch the ABC or the Fox.com, you know, on your television if it's not through the current Google TV or the things that are, you know, that you've been talking about.
Well, I mean, the only way to do it where the television companies are okay with it is to plug a computer straight into your television. You know, it's not something that, you know, when the service becomes available, you know, the Hulu.com where you can, you know, it aggregates all those television shows. When you first go to that website from, you know, a Google TV or, you know, a phone that can stream Flash media, it pops up pretty clearly and says, you know, we really don't want you to see this content unless you're on a computer. We haven't written an application for this service yet, so we need you to move on. So, you know, as far as being able to access that, you know, on your television, your best bet really is to connect a computer to it.
Is there something out there today that takes just a regular, you know, where you would plug your monitor into your computer and convert that into an HDMI that you can plug right into a TV today?
Sure, absolutely. There are several different ways that you can accomplish that, and most of them can be found at, you know, local electronic shops. The adapters are pretty easy to come by.
Hey, thanks very much. Great show today.
Thank you, Lawrence. And thanks to everyone else. Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us.
Not a problem. I had a lot of fun today.
Do we know what's on tap for next week yet?
I do not know what's on tap for next week yet. I'm going to come up with something fun, though.
Okay. We love the mysteries. Russell Holly, tech blogger at geek.com. Thanks again. And thanks to everybody for listening. And remember, you can receive daily updates from our show by liking All Sides with Ann Fisher on Facebook or by following me on Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU. And be sure to visit WOSU.org/All Sides to explore the audio and video archive of every show. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1 and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.